I'm going to start with a little bit of introduction. This is more appropriate for the discussion this evening, but I won't be able to participate in that discussion, so I thought I would give a little bit of input into that now, and hopefully, you know, if you have questions, they can be discussed then. So I've been doing this, and, you know, in general, people have been doing this for a couple of years now, and I think, if not a clear picture, at least some clear questions are emerging. So I wouldn't say that it's established that there's a landscape of string theory vacua. I'm describing here what I mean by that term, both that you know, we have this potential solution to the cosmological constant problem, which is the attractive part of the idea, and that we have this huge proliferation of useless vacua, and great difficulty in sorting through them to find the interesting ones. That's been true for a long time, and this is just recognizing and trying to deal with that more systematically. Now, if one tries to make the idea more precise, of course, there are a lot of points to work on, and I listed a few broad categories of these here. So one of the points that often gets cited in trying to decide if this is right or not is this question of whether you can use analyses based on low energy effective field theory and those ideas. And I won't discuss that point except indirectly. Another point which Brian's not here, so I don't have to apologize to him, but I think one of the reasons that people dislike this idea is this, of course, there was this deep-seated belief that the theory of our universe should be pretty and special, and string theory is certainly pretty and special, and this is really going very much against that, to say that at the very least a cosmological constant, and potentially any feature of the theory, comes out of some much more complicated thing with lots of seemingly arbitrary choices and only justified by the results. Now, to some extent, what substitutes for the beauty of the particular solution for our universe is the beauty of the overall structure that contains them. So I firmly believe that. That's one reason I work on this, is that I think the questions about this overall structure are likely to have nice and simple and pretty answers, even if our vacuum is one of the relatively complicated ones. But it's not at all obvious, that this is true. Maybe there is some particularly simple and preferred vacuum just for on its own grounds. Of course, we only know directly about tiny corners of this landscape at present when we talk about non-supersymmetric and even n equals 1. We don't know, I come back to I omitted 4 because, of course, the point I'm going to focus on is that this is really, in a way, the best posed of these questions. They're all important to work on. This question of the weighting of vacua came up in previous talks, but this one we can work on some more, both on a more formal and phenomenological level, and it really underlies a lot of the other things. So I want to make this introduction very short. A question came up during and after Miriam's talk. Well, how does one study, the landscape of vacua that come out of toroidal orientification, uniform compactifications, or substitute your favorite model? And, conceptually, the idea is extremely simple. What I would say, all that one has to add to that study is if you want to pick a concrete question like, what fraction of models realize the standard model, then instead of just trying to construct standard models and realize their features and throwing out and ignoring everything else, you try to keep more systematic track both of the standard models and the non-standard models, and then you get a fraction of all the models, all the vacua you constructed, which ones are standard models. And it's not phenomenology in the sense that we obviously are never going to observe these non-standard models, but it's a lot of useful information about the theory, and you're just throwing it away if you only focus on the standard models. So in that sense, I would ask the phenomenologists, to broaden their interest somewhat, just as, I would ask the formal theorists to say, we really do want a vacuum, that realizes the standard model and breaks supersymmetry and all this stuff. And so, whenever you pose a question like this, you can start to come up with interesting questions to follow on it, you know, such as in that case, do I get a consistent fraction of standard models out of different constructions? If I don't, then why? You know, it's pretty clear that Brownian constructions in the heterotic string, the perturbative heterotic string, I should say, intuitively give you very different structure of the gauge group and probably distributions of gauge groups and breaking patterns. But can we say something more precise than that? You know, is that really just a property of the perturbative heterotic string, or is it really true that there are different regions of the landscape with those different properties? One has to be a little more systematic to decide that. And eventually, you know, the sort of goal that we can't do, but I would, you know, state is that we want to get statistics of big enough sets to make these standard tests of duality. So we ought to be able to say a large set of type 2 vacua that we think are dual to some large set of heterotic or M3 or whatever vacua really do roughly agree in this statistical sense of numbers of vacua and very rough characteristics of the distribution. And if that, at the end of the day, doesn't work, then that's really concrete evidence against the assumption, such as this effective, this idea that you can use effective field theory language in the effective potential, which is sort of hard to get at directly. And, you know, conversely, one can confirm the picture. So that's sort of the main formal thing I see on the horizon. And then eventually, if we could actually get some solid understanding of this, I think this is very important, as I've, you know, said many times, for guiding phenomenology. And one can distinguish these various possibilities that, you know, really, you know, shape the whole discussion based on the rough number of vacua. So, you know, one, you know, we're, as I said, sort of happy that we have enough to solve the cosmological constant problem. But it's really not at all proven. You know, there are a lot of cuts and possible instabilities and consistency conditions. Even if you buy into this framework, it might turn out, doesn't look like now, but it might turn out that we get too few vacua to solve the cosmological constant problem. This is this range where I've assumed, you know, the current answers sort of point towards the high end of this regime. And this is very interesting because you really can hope, you know, you think about these problems, and it really should be true that large regions of the a priori theory space with different, even, you know, mechanisms for either supersymmetry, supersymmetry breaking, and so forth, really have too few models to solve the cosmological constant problem and get everything else right. And so that's the case where you get either predictions in the strongest case, or some sense that some options are more natural than others without making further assumptions. But once there's that number of vacua, if it really were much larger, and again, sort of uniformly spread around, you know, things that could look like the standard model, quasi-realistic, then pretty much everything starts to get populated. And then you have to start to ask these questions about selection principles that will further cut down or weigh the possibilities. And then finally, if you, again, think about this, as the number of vacua gets sufficiently large, depending on your selection principles, even these things become very hard to justify. I'll go into that a little bit more later, because the most basic question, of course, of the previous discussion assumed is that the number of vacua is finite at all. And this is by no means obvious, of course. You know, the number of potential field theories is finite and is infinite. And there are infinite series of, quote, string compactifications, very well-known ones like ADS5 cross S5 with different values of flux. Now, that one decompactifies the S5 as the amount of flux gets large. And so that pretty clearly, there comes some point where you say that's not quasi-realistic. You would observe the Kaluza Klein states. And so it's very reasonable to cut those out just on grounds that we're looking for the ones that agree with the data. And there are lots of potential sources of infinite series, but the ones I know about in any detail at all actually get removed by this condition. And there's enough other non-trivial reasons that the number is finite at this point. The one that first impressed me is that if you look at a particular heterotic string in Calabi-Yau, you ask what determines the number of generations. It's, you know, C3 of the vector bundle that you choose. And there's no obvious mathematical constraint that makes the number of possibilities finite. Maybe you can have an arbitrarily large number of generations. But it turns out that, in fact, there is a bound. And one has to conjecture most of the ingredients that were going to this finiteness, like the fact that the number of Calabi-Yau threefolds is finite. Well, it's not a fact. Some people don't believe it, but there's some evidence for it. And I think trying to get a handle on this question is really the most important formal question, even prior to these questions about duality and getting the things to work. And again, this will be a bit controversial, I think. I expect, for example, Guy and Valley to make an opposed argument to this later, but I would say that once you start seeing any infinite value choices within the set of quasi-realistic constructions, things that might have some chance to look like the standard model, well, it's not just going to be in the observable sector where you can say, well, yes, out of these many choices, some large number of them produce low-scale supersymmetry breaking or some other nice feature. It's also going to be infinite numbers of choices in the hidden sector. So far as we know, the string theory doesn't care which sector is which. It's just because we're here that we call this one observable and the other one hidden. And so there'll be proliferations of choices every place, and making different variations to the hidden sector, they're not totally decoupled. They all make little changes to the observable physics. So taking advantage of those infinitely many choices throughout the theory, you start to find that you can arbitrarily adjust things in the observable sector and get pretty unconstrained physics. You can talk about selection factors and so forth, but if you have to multiply, it takes a lot of factors to multiply by infinity, to make a difference. It really qualitatively changes the story. And the cosmologists have recognized this for a long time. A lot of these issues have been discussed by cosmologists about selection principles and so forth. And definitely, once you start having an infinite number of candidate theories, you very quickly run into paradoxes and difficulties of interpretation. If it really came to that, you would have to hope that one of these wave functions or selection functions gives a weight, which if you sum over all the vacua, really converges. I think if you don't have that, you give up at that point. At that point, you could discuss what this gives you, but I still think at this point the evidence is that the number of vacua is finite, but this could easily be refuted by just finding one infinite series. It really comes out of string theory and doesn't get cut by such a simple cut. Yeah. Right. Well, this is kind of playing around. These are relatively easy exercises to do. So one of them is the volume of the coupling space of the standard model. If you count the cosmological constant, the Higgs is this 10 to the 240, 10 to the minus 240 in natural units. And that's kind of what sets this range. And then if you play around with what we think about distributions of gauge groups and hidden sectors. Another example that sets the high or this type of number is that you might say one of the most disfavored things I know about in string theory that still fits into field theory in principle is the idea that the fine structure constant is time varying. Because of course, if you think about it, this is just, I read a paper with Banks and Dine about this. Since we know very well there are corrections, the vacuum energy depends on the fine structure constant through lots of known quantum corrections. To get this to happen, you have to tune at least 8 coefficients into Taylor expansion of the effective potential function of alpha to an accuracy of at least 10 to the minus 60, the scale that we know these things work. So that's a ridiculous amount of fine tuning. But of course, if there are 10 to the 1,000 vacua, you might say, well, 10 to the 500 fine tuning, probably exists there somewhere. And it's like any reasonable person would say this is obviously wrong, but that's the sort of thing you would run into. But this is definitely the sort of thing, with this number, the selection, the sort of function that Henry Tighe talked about is much more highly peaked than this, so it just would rapidly throw out a lot of these. Yeah. Well, the basic input I take, the basic input I'm taking at this level, I'm just considering things you can see directly in the low energy theory myself, such as the cosmological constant that we think we observe today. Of course, one can ask about the possibility of modeling that with other forms of dark energy. Now, of course, in principle, there's nothing stopping you from bringing in early cosmology constraints and saying that the vacuum, the correct theory, of course, our vacuum today must come out of some, reasonable postulated inflationary potential and so forth. And those are all constraints that one should put into the game. So, the philosophy I've spoken at length about this in the past is that there are all these factors, and clearly you need to combine them all, as phenomenologists always do. But no one of them is really the controlling factor. So you need some technology that lets you say which things are easy and hard in a quantitative way, and combine them in a quantitative way. Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, that I wouldn't say that we've answered that question. I believe the standard model gauge group and matter spectrum is relatively easy. You know, I gave rough arguments in my first papers that that's 10 to the minus 15 or 10 to the minus 20. I wouldn't take a particular number too seriously, but you know, certainly much, much greater than 10 to the minus 100. And then I think that the main kind of undetermined number, which I'll talk a bit more about later, is to get acceptable supersymmetry breaking. I mean, I suspect that's not very hard either. Well, the couplings themselves, well, no, I suspect that's right. I mean, it could have been incredibly hard to get realistic inflation, but again, that's not the feeling right now. The feeling is that's 10 to the 120. Yeah, no. Yeah, no, I was just producing a broad range. They obviously are quite different, but I'm making the point that that's the range where, on the one hand, you can solve, in principle, solve all the known problems. There wouldn't be some immediate argument that you can't solve the cosmological constant problem, but you can hope to get predictions without assuming additional selection principles. You will find that there are many regions of theory space which are not populated. So that's what defined the lower and the upper bound of that region. Yeah, the way the problem looks at right now, that's right, that's just a coincidence of huge numbers of a sort that there's no sign of within the theory. If it works at all, you know, it's going to, you know, Yeah, that's right. It's conceivable that we're just on the edge of something, but that's not the way string theory looks. Basically, because so much of the theory is inaccessible to observation. You know, why this particular part that we observe should control the problem? Yeah. Well, some people, no, definitely it's a worthy thing to work on, and then one can only judge it once it's proposed. People worked on this intensively, you know, 2000 to 2002 or so in string theory. There was the hope that, you know, embedding in higher dimensions would solve the problem quickly. At the moment, people, I believe, don't have any clear hope in that direction, but obviously if something comes along, it's important to consider. Okay, so anyhow, the flux vacua. So we have a lot of results for these 2B flux vacua. There's recently been studies of, for example, M theory on G2 by Bobby Acharya and collaborators. And at this point, the kind of very broad distinction to draw is that many of these problems, the M theory on G2, the original heterotic on the Calabi-Yau, you have a set of fluxes which is comparable to the number of real moduli fields that you're trying to fix. And what typically happens then is you can postulate fluxes and you fix all the moduli, but then the problem is determined and you just find that the cosmological constant is of order of the string scale or, you know, whatever is the underlying scale. And then in this 2B problem, we actually have two sets of fluxes. Now, the choice from Ramon give us twice as many, roughly, fluxes as real moduli, and then you get this ability to start tuning things and getting additional cancellations that bring down the cosmological constant. And then finally, F and M theory on fourfolds has many more fluxes in general than these moduli. There's not such a tight constraint. It depends on the model in that case, but there are models where this ratio is greater than 2, and you again expect to be able to tune the cosmological constant. So then the simplest result to study is a density function that counts vacua, has a delta function for each supersymmetric vacuum, just to get warmed up. You know, it's obviously theoretically more accessible, and controls the ADS cosmological constant. So you count both types. And you put in the sine factor, which theoretically makes things much, much easier. It makes the problem sort of like the Witten index, which is, of course, much more controllable than, you know, actually counting ground states. And that sign doesn't seem to make a huge difference, you know, to results. You can then, you know, in some cases solve the problem of actually counting the vacuum, but you can get very, very, you know, broad general results in simple formulas if you put this sign in. So So I think the basic result is still the one I got with my student Sujay Ashok, that says that this density is a prefactor, which is basically the type discussed by Busseau and Polchinski, a volume of a sphere in the space of fluxes, but whose radius now is set by this tadpole parameter of the 2B or unifold construction. So it has, you know, it's a topological thing. It's nice in that way. And then that number of flux vacua, volume of the sphere, number of possible fluxes, gets multiplied by a density in moduli space, complex structure in dilaton, which you simply construct from the Kähler form. So in the best posed case, you assume that you're at large volume, but you're fixing the complex structure in dilaton. So you know the Kähler potential on this complex structure moduli space. That's the Kähler form. That's the curvature you make from it. And you get this natural density. And then this tells you for any given region of moduli space, you integrate the leading estimate for large L of how many vacua sit in that region, of course, weighed with this sign. Okay, and then another basic result, which came out of Bobby Acharya's work and came out also in work I did with Frederick Denneff, characterizing black hole attractor points. So it's a formally very similar problem with, you know, one set of charges, you know, number of charges proportional number of moduli. You, as I said, don't have really room to tune the cosmological constant. You also don't have this control parameter like the tadpole. But because you can't tune the cosmological constant, you can just use it as a control parameter. And so as a function of cosmological constant, you get a power law growth, the number of, you know, basically the number of cycles. And then the geometric factor on the moduli space weighing this is the volume constructed from the Kähler metric on the moduli space. So the results are kind of intuitive, especially this one is just what you might have guessed a priori, that any given potential wants to have one vacuum per Planck volume in this configuration space. And the other formula at generic points in moduli space where this doesn't get big looks kind of similar to that. And so the scale here is being set, of course, by the structure of supergravity. In effect, you have, you know, the connection with the one over n Planck, you know, and the thing that sort of introduces variation into the potential on that scale of n Planck and configuration space. So they are different distributions. They don't really depend on the same parameters, so you can't literally compare them. But you know, definitely the previous one, you look at examples where you think there's some duality, and this one describes many more vacua and has this possibility of tuning the cosmological constant. And so one, I think, takes from that is Simeon Hellman, you know, expressed very clearly in his talk that you know, these other constructions that should be dual to 2B must have more choices that are dual to all these choices of the second flux in 2B. And so it's important to find out what they are. Simeon advocated, and I think he's right, that in the 2A mirrors, the NS flux duals to non-geometric choices of a type that he described. In the heterotic case, one can try to say that, but there are other clear options. The choice of gauge bundle has a huge degeneracy and does contribute to this in a way comparable to the flux, and some of it might be tied up with the choice of gauge bundle. And then if you look at F theory on fourfold really contains 2B and heterotic string, you know, as special cases, and so you really can compare. And I think you also see that there are, from that point of view, many F theory choices that are non-perturbative in this heterotic language, and so you have to bring those in as well. And again, this is a sufficiently explicit sort of comparison that I think one could understand it on this level. Okay, so now there could be even more choices, and I'll mention at the end, you know, F theory seems to bring in even more choices. So is this distribution I wrote of this type really what we expect to come out in the end, or is this, you know, something which will get corrected again once we put in even more choices? And it's hard to know, but there is a simple argument that this is sort of universal, and one evidence for that is that it actually appears in my first paper before we computed it with Sujay Ashok. And it's basically the natural answer to the mathematical question. If you had a superpotential on some sort of a compact configuration space, what would the Witten index be? How would you count the number of vacua with signs? And that problem is topological, and the answer clearly is the integral of this density over that space. So it's not much of a jump to say, well, you know, if it's a very general, if there's anything universal and it has to agree with this, if you integrate it over a compact space, it had better be this. You know, and one can dress up that argument in some ways. But I think that is a reason to think that this is a fairly universal form. But of course, one has to check it against examples with more choices and more fluxes. OK, so some properties of this distribution, again, all pointed out in talks over the last year or two. So the curvature term definitely leads to an enhancement of vacua near conifold points, you know, mathematically, because the curvature diverges there. And Guy de Valley will give physical arguments for this type of enhancement. But this divergence is integrable. So the total number of vacua does not diverge. But it's definitely the case that near the conifold point where you have a gauge dual, it's the log of the hierarchically small scale that gets uniformly distributed to a good approximation. And so it's right that hierarchically small scales are common in string theory, but they're by no means the majority of vacua. If you look at simple examples, you know, maybe 5% of them will have a hierarchically small scale, smaller than 10 to the minus 6. You have that sort of thing. You know, most of the vacua don't do it, but a much larger fraction than 10 to the minus 6 would do it. OK, another general result is basically in these sort of simpler, recoupling large volume regimes, the volume on the moduli space is a good approximation. And then these volumes are known, and they tend to fall off as you move off into these regimes. So for example, it's familiar that the volume of the fundamental region of the upper half plane in which the dilaton lives is finite. It's pi over 3 if you integrate this metric. And if you convert this to actual distribution of gauge couplings, you find that it's basically uniform. So if you want the gauge coupling to be 1 over 25 or less, then the fraction of vacua through that is 1 over 25. And there's not some huge population of vacua off at order 1 because it gets cut off by the duality. OK, but then there are effects of having many moduli. OK, so you might try to stabilize, use this freedom. You have many, many Kähler moduli. We'll just grant we go over to the mirror. Use this ability to have lots of choices of flux to try to cook up the rare vacuum with large extra dimensions just stabilized by flux. And you find it doesn't really work because this volume factor actually, this dependence on the volume of the collabial itself. So there's two volumes now. And this is the volume on configuration space. Now if you ask, take that volume on configuration space, all Kähler metrics, Ritchie flat metrics, and the space of Kähler parameters. And now just ask, as a function of the ultimate volume of the collabial, how many, how is that distributed? You find that it falls off very fast as this number of moduli grows. It's sort of like the product of many of these cusp-like fundamental regions. And you get a huge suppression out there for many, many, many things going to weak coupling and large volume, in particular for the overall volume. So there's already interesting structure even in what looks like the kind of most naive approximation. And the general thing I think this is a very important result. So one of the most basic questions you could ask, of course, is in statistics, it's very easy to add up many effects and get basically Gaussians and concentration results, like the central limit theorem. You toss a lot of coins, and you get as many heads as tails. And that's a very common thing statistically to concentrate. And on the other hand, if you put some special structure and symmetry in the problem, you can also get very uniform distributions. And so it's just, for every sector of theory, which thing is a more reasonable picture. And I would say for this flux sector, things look not totally uniform, but to some zeroth approximation uniform. And that's not to say there's no structure. There's a huge amount of structure coming from the structure of these moduli spaces. But it's not a structure that just immediately concentrates you on some point. But it could be for other aspects of the problem that you do get concentrated. It just remains to be seen. OK, now another important thing about this is that this volume form actually has been, there are very general arguments that the total volume of a collabial moduli space is finite. It's a highly non-trivial result. They have hundreds of parameters, and you get this in some indirect way. And to some extent, these arguments actually generalize to the density which appears in the 2D flux vacua. And the basic idea does is sort of technicalities. If R grows sufficiently fast, it might spoil it. But the simple examples like the conifold and others, it doesn't. And the number of vacua is finite there. And then the main kind of non-trivial thing, mathematically making this claim, is that there are general arguments that if there's going to be a divergence, it's already going to happen in codimension 1 by tuning one parameter. And that's what the claim that one can prove any of these statements rests on. So I don't totally understand or accept the arguments yet, but this is certainly, the, at least for the volume, the general wisdom of the mathematicians and people work on proving this. So the formulas I wrote down are this limit of the tabful number being large, or the cosmological constant being large, where you can neglect flux quantization. There's a huge amount of structure in the problem if you put in the flux quantization, and I expect Oliver DeWolf to go into some of this in detail. In particular, you have special techniques. If the periods have a lot of special structure, if they're algebraic numbers, you can just solve and enumerate the flux vacuum. And you find that there are definitely enhancements where you would have discrete symmetry in W equals zero in simple models. What remains to be seen is, again, you know, if you have many moduli, are these numbers of vacuum that preserve discrete symmetry really comparable? Do they carry this huge power of the number of cycles? So the naive argument that one is finding against in that claim is to say, suppose you want a Z2 symmetry, then you might imagine that some fraction, let's say a half of the fluxes, preserves Z2 symmetry, and some other fraction breaks Z2 symmetry. And then if you want it, you're only allowed to turn on those half of the fluxes. And so you get the square root of the original number, the power of the exponent, which is this number of fluxes, got halved. And that's the naive estimate. And it will, it remains to be seen whether subtleties, structure within the problem can increase that number. Okay, so now let's talk about supersymmetry breaking. This got a lot of attention because there is this sort of obvious loophole in the arguments that low-energy supersymmetry is the favorite way to solve the hierarchy problem, which is that there is some definite tuning factor that you save by postulating low-energy supersymmetry, getting it to mediate, and all the standard construction. It's in the order of 10 to the minus 35, maybe 10 to the minus 40. But that's not a huge number in this business. And if there were 10 to the 50 vacuum to do it in some other way, just by straight tuning, then they would win. And a little bit more quantitatively, if you have gravity mediation, the mediation goes, the effective Higgs mass goes as the fourth power of the supersymmetry breaking scale, because it's this generic kind of soft mass. So if the number of vacua grows this fast, then you start to prefer the high scales with the, with the underlying supersymmetry breaking scale. Okay, and so now, actually working this out, of course, there's not just some simple universal distribution. There are lots of mechanisms of supersymmetry breaking, and in principle, you just have to add them all. They're all possibilities, and you have to know which one, at least the relative numbers, the ratio of things that break supersymmetry to different ways, as well as some estimate of these distributions for the different ones. And so I listed a few very broad possibilities that people draw on. And with the DENF, we studied, and last November published results on this idea that you can purely, just within the flux potentials that we've already studied, find supersymmetry breaking vacuum. And there's a simple, the analysis is very general, but the generic thing that comes out is very simple to explain. It's pointed out by Michael Dine and his students that the generic thing to happen is that the fluxes lift all but one of the moduli, and then you just have to start tuning parameters in an effective superpotential, and you can see that, in fact, you have to tune three parameters. Obviously, dW is the scale of supersymmetry breaking. This one controls the mass of a potential Goldsteino, which is required for a sensible supersymmetry breaking. That has to be small as well. And then finally, you can show that the third derivative of the superpotential controls the possibility of tachyons, and if that's not small, you always get a tachyon. So you have to tune three complex parameters, and then that leads to this, F to the 6 type of behavior, M sub Z to the 12 behavior. So it's a very rapid fall off, with the lowering of the scale, basically because you don't have this one underlying mechanism. So then the thing you look for is, of course, within the flux vacuum, is there something that ties all these parameters together so you don't have to tune them all separately? And so far as we could tell, without obviously, it requires details of Calabi-Yau geometry, there is not. And there is just, the thing which is surprising is that there are these, It's certainly clear that flux vacuum can produce hierarchically small scales, so I told you before. But the terms, if you try to get all three terms into superpotential, there's always some sort of order one slot left over from turning on other fluxes, which then you just have to tune away. So this only helps you to a limited extent. And this doesn't literally solve the problem of supersymmetry breaking. Again, as far as we could tell, there might be some mechanism there. But rather, what I tend to think is that the idea, so what would make this result of much more importance than just saying it's some class of flux vacuum is that there are lots of known and understood examples where you derive gauge theories by embedding brains and string theory, and then it really is dual to fluxes. Okay, so it's a very general phenomenon. The simple picture would have been that you can always do that. Then this preceding argument would be extremely strong. Would you say that, well, you thought you could break supersymmetry dynamically on these brain gauge theories, but if you carefully derive them, there would be these extra order one terms into Lagrangian coming basically from embedding them into supergravity, which would spoil it. And it's conceivable that that's the lesson, but the other possible lesson, of course, is that this gauge flux duality is not understood in generality. The arguments that I understand best for it assume, in fact, that the matter is non-chiral, which is, of course, the case where you don't break supersymmetry. And it could be that the interesting theories are precisely the ones where you don't have this duality. The gauge theory dynamics controls all three, you know, the whole effective superpotential, you know, and so all these scales are tied together. And then you can get back the low scale. So I think that's the next question in terms of addressing this, you know, question of, you know, whether at least you're based on the information at hand, does string theory prefer to lower to high scale. There are some other things which have to come out in a reasonable fraction of vacuum. Obviously, you have to solve the mu problem, and it has to be that, you know, you generate this, you know, huge pile of hidden sector gauge theories from all these constructions, and we know some of them break supersymmetry, but if it turned out that out of the guys that actually come out of string theory, if only a fraction 10 to the minus 30 break supersymmetry, you would again be a problem. You know, but these are all things that you can estimate. And having settled that question, I think you could then go on to ask questions about preferred mechanisms of mediation and so forth. So I'm almost done. I wanted to briefly mention some results of the Munich group, Ralph Blumenhagen is here and the others, who have started to look systematically at the distribution of these gauge theories in matter content, which was a necessary input to what I talked about in the last slide. And the basic picture that they have from looking at brains on tori is that you have to solve, again, tadpole conditions, and that to the extent that the tadpole is large, you're just partitioning a given set of tadpole numbers over a set of brains, and the behavior is captured by the behavior of partitions with small corrections. And so with simple spectrum of brains, it seems clear that this sort of result is right, and you get very concrete statements about the distribution and matter content. And again, I think this could be done in more generality. We do know something about the spectrum of brains on more general Calabi-Yau. So these sort of results implicitly are right if the spectrum of brains is sort of roughly constant. For every value of these, wrapping or tadpole numbers, you have roughly order one different brain. You know, that's the implicit assumption in getting those particular results. And if the number of brains grows faster or slower than that, you would get modified results. But again, I think, you know, at least these large L limits are accessible using these sorts of ideas. And one could get some believable, simple, model of the distribution of gauge roots and of chiral matter content. Now, to go on and talk about this supersymmetry breaking question, you obviously have to know something about the superpotential, which is very complicated. I mean, it's attractive, the sort of idea we heard in Nelson's talk that you know, the natural assumption is just that any term that's allowed is there and is independent. But there are mathematical reasons to doubt that. So that's another thing that one could test. There is some independent information. If, to the extent that that's valid, then I think you could answer this question based on what we know, some estimate of the number of theories that break supersymmetry. Okay, so I'll finish there and just raise a few more open questions. That's the sort of thing that we've been able to do, although they're sort of, on the one hand, generic, the best results are sort of, generic things, but I think they show already non-trivial structure within the problem, and they have some chance to be universal. Let's see, another very general question to ask in this type 2B context is to what extent the whole problem is coupled, and to what extent there are really decoupled sectors. So one precise way to say that is if you vary a flux over here on some cycle, do all of the moduli vary by some significant amount, or do just the moduli in some sense near, for the cycles near that one vary? And this bears on a lot of things, actually, when you start to think about it. If they decouple, it turns out that you can you also get this huge enhancement of the high-scale models. That was the implicit assumption in a paper that Soskind wrote, and I wrote a similar paper last June. So if the various cycles on your Calabi are really decoupled, then you could independently break study supersymmetry breaking on each sector of the theory and then add up the results. And then you very quickly find, you know, power laws heavily favoring high-scale supersymmetry breaking. So presumably this is, you know, not true and the things couple to each other to some extent, but that remains to be made precise. We started to ask questions like what fraction is to be vacuous stabilized the Kähler moduli. I didn't get into that, but we start to know enough to do that. We start to get results for other constructions. And I think the prime question in this regard is whether we can convince ourselves that the dualities that we think are there are valid and that the number of choices on, you know, each side, these rough distributions, do agree. So that will be some stage at which we can say that, yes, we have a at least self-consistent picture of that part of string theory that we know about. And for most of the constructions, that requires, I think, finding more choices. But for F theory, on fourfold, it seems that we have too many choices, or at least far more than the 2B oriental fold. So the number of cycles on a fourfold and even this tabular number can be quite a bit larger and lead to, you know, 10 to the thousand, even, you know, 10 to the few thousand sort of numbers. And so a very, obviously very important question is whether these really are all real choices in the F theory, or when you start getting into the details of these, it's a very confusing situation, the detailed interpretation of F theory and N equals one supersymmetry breaking. And you can at least, you know, cook up reasons why a lot of these choices would go away if you proceed into the analysis. So that remains to be seen, the comparison with this number, whether the current sorts of 10 to the 400 are right, or these much larger numbers are suggested by F theory. And finally, I think dualities to, you know, very different constructions, especially ABS-CFT, would really provide a confirmation of, you know, this landscape picture. And you know, if you could reproduce statistics from that, that would be a, you know, fairly dramatic confirmation. I expect Shamit will mention these ideas, but it's a you know, another, you know, basically this general goal of continuing, I would say, that the progress of the late 90s on duality, which got tied up with N equals one theories, I would say largely for technical reasons, just that it's a very complicated problem and understanding it in detail is a huge amount of effort, as are most things in, you know, string phenomenology. But hopefully there are simple things to be said about these distributions, and if there are, we should be able to find them. So I'll stop there.
One quick question.
Well, formally, the framework totally carries over. In the paper with I wrote with Deneff, you know, it gets very detailed results for these non-supersymmetric, you know, V prime equals zero coming out of the flux potential. Now, you could ask about the assumptions, you know, whether perhaps for some reason we should more trust these superpotentials that we, you know, I think we're close to justifying these things for kind of large volume semi-classical, and there's already a lot of vacua out there, and I don't see any reason why, if you break supersymmetry well below the Planck scale, you should any less trust that effective field theory picture that is justified, or, you know, close to being justified. Now, you could ask, as you continue into stronger coupling and quantum effects and so forth, perhaps, you know, clearly, you know, it's easier to understand the supersymmetric case. But no, I don't see any evidence for the claim that there's some fundamental difference between those problems. And certainly you can enumerate and study these distributions formally, and I think eventually find dualities between large sets of non-supersymmetric vacua. So that would provide some justification in the end.
I think there were several other people wanting to ask questions, but we do have the landscape discussion this afternoon. So let's postpone that for those for this afternoon. Okay, our next speaker is Keith Dienis, and he's going to. Oh, thank Mike.
Can we move this, or? Okay. Oops.